that in order to benefit all sentient beings whose numbers fill the extent of space, I must attain the level of perfect enlightenment. In order to bring this about, I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation. So now we'll fulfill the meditation part of our intention. With the two wings of awakening, cultivating wisdom and compassion from the first two points of the 7 points of mind training, beginning by bringing our minds to rest again, just checking in with our posture, letting everything settle for a moment. This is something we can do again and again throughout the day. Whenever we realize that we're not settled, we could settle. Just let go of whatever is driving us in that moment. And just bring the mind to rest. So we will contemplate the four reminders very briefly. Everybody knows them, and we're going to be talking about the first one in detail today in class, the precious human existence. I'll read them all from the Nundar text. First, I must meditate on this precious human existence with its freedoms and resources, difficult to attain, easily destroyed. From now on, I must make this life meaningful. Secondly, everything is impermanent. The world in all it contains, in particular the life of beings, is as fragile as a bubble of water. The time of death is uncertain. And when I die, I will be nothing but a corpse. At that time, only the Dharma can help me. I must practice diligently. Thirdly, at the time of death, I will not be free. My fate will depend upon my previous actions. I must therefore refrain from negative actions, always engage in positive actions, and each day attend to my stream of being. Fourthly, all places, friends, pleasures, possessions, and everything else in the cycle of samsara continually torment me through the three types of suffering. They are like the last meal before my execution. I must sever all attachment and diligently accomplish enlightenment. So now, coming back to just that state of rest, of being in touch with the nature of mind, if we have cultivated that capacity. We bring to mind our guru or the Buddha or deity of our choice or Gampopa above the crown of our head on a lotus and moon seat, smiling, radiating love, compassion, bodhicitta, awakening, and aspiring to, through our own efforts, attain that same state. We request the blessings of the Lama to empower us to do that. So just thinking in a very heartfelt way that we would like, we wish to attain awakening. We wish to perfect wisdom and compassion and bodhicitta. And thinking that we have received the blessing just by requesting it and being receptive to it, we allow the Lama or the Buddha or Gampopa or a deity to descend through the crown of our head and come to rest in our heart center, in a pavilion of light where they reside, even when we're not aware of them. So with our practice empowered, we will now come back to a state of resting, of shine, letting go of whatever thoughts and emotions may arise in our experience. We just let them come and go as we cultivate ultimate bodhicitta, look at all experience as a dream, everything we're worried about in this moment or on this day. Tomorrow it'll be just like last night's dream. Or maybe next year. Or maybe in several years. Just letting its solidity fade. And then turning our attention to examine the nature of awareness, which is unborn, looking at the mind and allowing ourselves to ask what it is. What is this mind? Does it have any identifiable characteristics? Can we box it in with a definition? Just looking at mind. Again, in a receptive state. And hearing Ken McLeod's voice saying, you cannot say. And then in step three, we let even the remedy release naturally, which means we don't have to forcefully eject whatever conclusions we came to about the mind, but we just let them fade away naturally like any other thought. Which brings us to step four, to rest in the essence, the basis of everything. This is our Buddha nature, which we talked about last week. This is the nature of our mind, which we'll be talking about throughout the book. Whether we feel we recognize it or not, we'll just rest in it. Without trying to contrive a special state of meditation, but just letting the mind be just as it is in this moment and through the flow of our experience. If we get caught in a thought, we just let it go. It's just part of the nature of mind that we're resting in. Just a wave on the ocean. And now, without needing to lose touch with that state of resting in an uncontrived way, with no hopes and fears for what our state of mind will be, in the essence, the basis of everything, the nature of our mind, we will cultivate relative bodhicitta, practice taking and sending alternately, synchronizing with the breath. And we're going to start out today in keeping with today's theme from Gampopa, bringing to mind all beings who have Buddha nature, the potential to awaken fully and become Buddha for the benefit of all beings, but who are lacking the first thing that they need, which is the precious human existence. So that includes all the beings in all the non-human realms, so we could bring to mind everyone suffering in the hell realms, the hungry ghost realm, the animal realm, in the ocean, on the land, in the sky, the realm, the competitive realm of the jealous gods, and the gods' realm of oblivious bliss, which will turn into suffering when they die. None of them have any opportunity, and some of them have no incentive to actually awaken and free themselves from suffering. So we could breathe that in. That suffering without the opportunity to work on it in this lifetime. Breathing that in and breathing out to them a precious human existence and relief from whatever suffering they're experiencing and stuck in. And then within the human realm, all human beings who don't have the circumstances to encounter the Dharma in any form, to practice it, to wake themselves up. breathing out to all of them our good fortune and our rejoicing in our good fortune of having the precious human existence, and wishing the same for them in a heartfelt way. All the cats and dogs, all the earthworms and all the birds, all the humans who are stuck in poverty or war or obliviousness. Still in touch with that sense of our vast, unlimited awareness. Even as we do Tonglen for those less fortunate than we are. And also for all the humans who have a precious human existence but don't have the circumstances or the wherewithal to put it to use. Or described in some detail in the Torch of Certainty. All the obstacles to practicing the Dharma even when you have a precious human existence. Breathing in those obstacles and breathing out a lack of obstacles. And now opening our awareness to include all sentient beings, including those with a precious human existence who are working hard to realize it. And breathing in whatever suffering any being has, with a heartfelt wish to free them of it by breathing out to them whatever they need. Including any specific beings who may come to mind as we're doing this practice. Including, if we can, people we consider enemies. People on the other side of wherever we are. Breathing in their suffering and breathing out healing, happiness, peace, fulfillment of all their needs, freedom. And now letting go of the visualization and conceptualization of Tonglen, coming back to just simply resting in the essence, the basis of everything, our Buddha nature. And now coming back to study mode at your own speed, in your own way. I will unmute everybody. Well, I guess I don't have to unmute everybody, but does anybody have anything they would like to say or ask before we get started on the precious human existence? I'm going to unmute Lama Jinzong so that she can participate freely if she has anything to add at any time. And hello to everybody who's joined us, Dan and Fanny and Carolyn and John. All right, I don't see anybody with a question or a comment yet, so here we go. Let me see if there was anything I needed to. Oh yeah, I wanted to say, I just first wanted to do my little, you know, my little recap, my very brief recap of, I'm just going to do it again because we can't hear this too many times. I'm going to read the introduction because it only takes less than a minute. This is how Gampopa introduces the ornament of precious liberation and gives us a compelling motivation to read the rest of the book and follow the path. He says, generally speaking, all phenomena can be categorized as either samsara or nirvana, nothing in between. With regard to samsara, its nature is emptiness, It manifests as confusion and it is characterized by suffering. With regard to nirvana, its nature is also emptiness. It manifests as the exhaustion and disappearance of all confusion, and it is characterized by freedom from all suffering. So samsara and nirvana are the same thing, basically. Only in one case we're confused and we suffer, and in the other case we're not confused and we don't suffer. And so what we're trying to do here is get from state A to state B. So who is confused in samsara? All sentient beings of the three realms. That's all of us. What is the basis of confusion? Confusion is projected onto emptiness. I think I'm gonna remute you, Lama Jinzong, but unmute yourself anytime. What is the cause of confusion? Fundamental ignorance. Ignorance of what? Ignorance of our true nature. Ignorance of the true nature of things. We project our confusion onto its true nature, which is emptiness, which is the nature of both samsara and nirvana. How does confusion manifest? As the experiences of the six types of beings. All of our experience, if we're within samsara, is confused experience. Is there a metaphor to describe confusion? It is like sleep and dreams. When did confusion begin? There has been confusion since beginningless time. What is the problem with being confused? All experience is suffering. When will confusion transform into wisdom? Not until unsurpassable awakening is attained. So how do we receive that awakening? For anyone who thinks confusion may clear up by itself, samsara is well known to be endless. So in light of the reality that samsara is nothing but confusion, how much suffering it involves and how long it lasts, and that it will never liberate itself, from this day forward, we must make every effort to attain unsurpassable awakening. What does this effort require? Those with discernment will come to know unsurpassable awakening through six topics summarized as the cause. We covered that last week. That was Buddha nature. The support or the basis, that's this week, precious human existence. And the condition, which is a qualified and authentic teacher. Those are the three prerequisites for the path. The fourth topic is the path itself, the method, the teachings of the teacher. And then the result, which is Buddhahood, and the activity, which is how the Buddha benefits beings non-conceptually. And that is, that's the ground of Ornament of Precious Liberation. So last week, under Lama Jinzong's guidance, we talked about the first chapter, the first prerequisite, Buddha nature, the good news being that everybody has that, all beings, all the earthworms, all the cats and dogs, all the birds, everybody's got Buddha nature. So if you need to review, if you wish to review, that point was proven through three kinds of evidence. That was scriptural, the Buddha said it, and then other awakened beings have echoed him. All beings have Buddha nature, through logic, because samsara and nirvana have the same nature, then the nature of Buddha is the same as the nature of us, which is Dharmakaya. So if we have the same nature as Buddha, then we have Buddha nature. And then through empirical evidence, which is you can look at people and see that they have different degrees of relationship to their Buddha nature. Some people totally disconnected. We may feel we see that from time to time in people we run across. No connection to Buddha nature. So they're going to take a long time to wake up. They don't even want to wake up yet. They might want to go to sleep more. Then the wishy-washy potential, which is like whichever way the wind blows is the way they go. So if they happen to encounter a teacher, then they follow a teacher and so forth. And which kind of teacher it is just depends on which kind they encounter. Then there's the third and the fourth potentials, which are the hearers and the self-realized Buddhas. And they can go a long way on the path through cultivating wisdom, but they haven't cultivated compassion yet. So the Buddha has all kinds of ways to communicate with them when the time comes. And the reason that that path is there, even though it's an incomplete path, is because it's an easier goal than full awakening. And there's a lot of benefit to getting halfway there. And then the Buddha lets you know you still got some work to do. So that's what seems to happen. And then we're very fortunate to have encountered Mahayana teachers, which means that we have Mahayana potential. That's the last potential, or the last and best degree of connection, closest degree of connection to Buddha nature. So we even have meditations on Buddha nature, resting in your Buddha nature like we just did. So that was the Buddha nature chapter. And now we're on to the second prerequisite for following the path, which is precious human existence. So today, like a lot of the time, we're probably going to be working mostly with Ringu Tulku, but today I'm going to take us mostly through Ornament of Precious Liberation, whichever version of it you have. If you have the jewel ornament, that's fine. If you don't have the book, that's fine. I'm just going to read it. But this is a chapter where Ringu Tulku follows Gampopa very closely. All the same points are there, all explained very, very clearly and very nicely. So if you don't have Ornament of Precious Liberation, you could also follow along in Ringu Tulku, and I'm going to bring him in from time to time as well, because he says some very helpful things that Gampopa either says in different words or maybe doesn't say. So I'm going to start at the beginning, and again, I'm in the Ken MacLeod Ornament of Precious Liberation, but it'll sound very similar to, if you have a different version, it'll be pretty much the same. So, given that all sentient beings have Buddha nature, can the five types of non-human beings, hell beings, hungry spirits, and so forth, attain Buddhahood? They cannot. Now, I'm emphasizing that a little bit because this is one of the parts of Ringu Tulku's book that mystifies me a bit. It's just a conundrum because he begins by saying, and he's on page 15, in his second paragraph, he says, although all beings have Buddha nature, certain forms of existence are not conducive to its development or realization. Same thing Gampopa is saying. But then he goes on to say, although theoretically it is possible to become enlightened in any form of existence, the easiest and best circumstance in which to attain our ultimate goal is as a human being. So he's much gentler than Gampopa there. He makes it sound like it could be possible in a different realm of existence or in a different situation to realize your Buddha nature and attain Buddhahood. But Gampopa seems to very clearly say no, they cannot. So Gampopa is saying you have to have a precious human existence. The excellent type of existence that provides a working basis for achieving Buddhahood is known as a precious human existence, meaning someone who materially has freedoms combined with assets, I call them resources, and who mentally has the three kinds of faith. So he's going to summarize that again at the end in almost the same words, but that's the basics of precious human existence. You have the freedoms, the eight freedoms from the eight unfree states. You have the 10 resources, and you have the three kinds of faith. And so I'm going to take a moment here to go to the handout. And if you don't have it, it's fine. We may pull it up onto the screen in just a moment, actually. Just going to the precious human existence reminder, one of the four thoughts from our Nundro, our preliminary practices by the ninth Karmapa Wangchuk Dorje. So here's what it says, and it's exactly a synopsis of like all of these points about the precious human existence that Gampopa is giving us. First, I must meditate on this precious human existence with its freedoms and resources. So it has the eight freedoms, it has the 10 resources. Difficult to attain, Gampopa is going to explain that. Easily destroyed, Gampopa is going to explain that, but we probably already are aware of that one, how easily we could lose our life. From now on, I must make this life meaningful. And he also is going to tell us in what way the precious human existence is meaningful, like what's the point of having the precious human existence and what makes it precious. So he says, still in the first paragraph, the synopsis of the explanation of this is the following. The very best basis, meaning the best precious human existence, is summed up in 5 points: freedoms, resources, conviction, meaning faith, aspiration, and clarity. And he'll explain those. Two of these are material. That would be the freedoms and the resources, I think, and three are mental, faith, aspiration, and clarity. They are freedoms in as much as the person is free from eight unfavorable conditions. So this is the first sort of key thing. It's very good to know these. And if you're on the Dharma path, you know that you have to memorize them on the Dharma path. At the very first level, first thing you do in the Dharma path is you memorize the eight freedoms and the 10 resources. So Agampopa states it as, he's quoting here from the Attention to Mindfulness Sutra. The eight unfavorable states are to be a hell dweller, a hungry spirit, an animal, a barbarian, a long-living god, someone with fixed aberrant views, one born in a time without a Buddha, or a person with severe difficulty in understanding. We're not going to go into a lot of detail about this because there's a lot of points to cover, but you know, if you need more detail, if you want to refresh your understanding, then you can read it here. You can read it in The Torch of Certainty. That's a fabulous place. And there's more detail in The Torch of Certainty about like the 16 things that keep you from getting a precious human existence again, if you have one now and you don't use it for whatever reason. So it's good to review all of these things. And I'm going to screen share for a moment because I translated this same passage from the Attention to Mindfulness Sutra in like a way that is metered, and to me that makes it easier to memorize. So it says, hell beings, ghosts and animals, uncivilized, long-living gods, wrong views, Buddha empty world, mute, these eight, the unfree states. Hell beings, ghosts and animals, uncivilized, long-living gods, wrong views, Buddha empty world, mute, these eight, the unfree states. Why are these states deemed unfavorable for the attainment of enlightenment? Hell is unsuitable because the very character of his experience is constant suffering. You have no leisure from suffering. In fact, the worst hell is called nonstop torture. That's its name. In hell, you're just so busy suffering that there's not a glimmer of anything else, any possibility. The hungry spirit state or the hungry ghost state is unsuitable because of its mental anguish. You're in such a state of need that your mind is all filled up with that. You don't have any mental energy to spare, and you're also suffering physically. You don't have what you need physically. You don't have what you need mentally. It fills your whole mind and you cannot apply yourself, even if you had the Dharma right in front of you. And it said, Pema Chodron said, there's a Buddha in every one of the six realms. And the suffering is for whatever reason, but in these two realms, it's because they're suffering so intensely. They don't see it. They can't recognize that there's actually help available. The animal state is unsuitable because it's of its general benightedness. Now, I thought that was an interesting word to use. I had to look that up. I actually had a slightly like different interpretation of it than what it means. It means, and it's a perfect word here. It's just that it's not like a common word. I was going to look in Jewel Ornament and see what the translation was there, but I ran out of time. Benightedness means moral or intellectual darkness, the state of being unenlightened, lack of knowledge. And that's that is like the animals are. They live in a certain mental darkness. And Pema Chodron, when we talk about these as psychological states, which Rinku Tulku does, and we may get to that if we have time, that paragraph in his book, animals are so, they're just blinded. They're so like in their routine, you know, that she says that's what the psychological state is about, is you just on your hamster wheel, don't bother me. You know, I'm just looking here. And also animals are always like, they're either looking for what they need to eat or they're looking to avoid being eaten. So they don't have any leisure. Even if the Dharma was in front of them, they, you know, we've all had like really smart pets. They can't read the Torch of Certainty. You can't really teach them, you know, the basics of Dharma, like however smart they are, they don't have the right kind of faculties to actually, take advantage of the Dharma, even if they live in a Dharma home. I mean, our cat in Niggling, Dee Dee, has been through like sixth, seventh, eighth. She's in her fourth retreat now, and she can't do the program. So these three states, the three lower realms, what we call the lower realms, these three states are also devoid of a sense of dignity or regard for others. Such beings do not really have any possibility of practicing Dharma because the above conditions render their general way of existing inappropriate for it. And I have a note here to refer to Ringu Tulku on page 16, the second page of his chapter. He says, a being who lives in any of these eight states has no opportunity to practice Dharma because the conditions are not right. They don't have the conditions. Indeed, if you are in one of these states, you're either too preoccupied with your own unhappiness. That's basically the three lower states mostly. And then, of course, that's basically the three lower states. Or too busy trying to enjoy yourself. That's the God's realms. To have any opportunity or motivation to practice Dharma. So Gampopa's next point. So we have now the eight unfavorable states. We're free of those, thank God. So we have the opportunity to wake ourselves up. His next point is the human realm, which is in between. Like some humans have the precious human existence and some don't. He says, though, the point he makes here is that in this respect, the relatively limited degree of manifest suffering present in human life is a helpful quality inasmuch as it fosters rejection of samsara, quells pride, gives rise to compassion for other beings, and makes us shun unwholesome action and appreciate virtue. And the way Pema Chödrön expressed that in her 2018 Omega retreat was that in the human realm, suffering and happiness alternate. So that, like, you're not so oppressed. Most people are not so oppressed with suffering that they don't have some happiness and some glimmer that things could be better. So they could have the motivation to wake up. And that's a point that's made in many texts, is that the human realm is the best place from which to practice the Dharma because we have just the right mix of suffering and happiness. So we can have the motivation and we can have the understanding that it's possible. Right, and I have a note here to go back to Ringu Tulku on page 16. Right, this is why it is said that the human realm, the human existence, is the perfect condition for the practice of Dharma. In this human body, we know about unhappiness, but we also have some leisure time. We are not completely controlled by our own conditionings. We have some freedom of will. At the same time, we see the problems of others, their troubles and their unhappiness, which gives us the opportunity to develop compassion and the motivation to work steadily toward the solution to these problems. So we're lucky to be in the human realm. And now back to Gampopa for the next topic. So that's the eight freedoms. We have the eight freedoms. So then in order to have a precious human existence, you also need the 10 assets or the 10 resources. Of these, five are personal and five are other related. Sometimes it's expressed that some are internal and some are external. Some are about like we bring to the situation and some we have to get from like our outside situation. So the five personal assets are described as to be human. And again, I have this on the handout, the list of the 10 internal resources and external resources. So the internal ones, to be born human, that's number one. To be born in a central land. And what that means is to be born in a country where there is a Dharma available. To be born with complete faculties, to have our faculties complete. And here it just means like if you have some kind of disability or some kind of impaired faculty that prevents you from actually understanding and practicing the Dharma, then you would not have the resource. But doesn't mean you couldn't be, you know, nowadays you could be blind, you could be deaf, you could have all kinds of, you know, impairments, but you could still have the resource of having enough, you know, enough ability to understand and practice the Dharma. The fourth one is a little hard to understand. Here it's called free from having committed the worst of actions. And in other places, I think Ringu Tulku calls it like not having a wrong livelihood. And what it seems to boil down to, I've surveyed all the resources I had, and what it seems to boil down to is, as I expressed it on the handout, free from insurmountable negative karma. What Gampopa seems to be saying here, as translated by Ken, free from having committed the worst of actions, it's referring to the 10 actions of immediate, I mean the 5 actions of immediate consequence, which I don't think I can reel them all off, but it's killing your mother, killing your father, killing or injuring a Buddha. I don't remember what the other two are. Do you, Lama Jinzong? Yeah.
One, I believe, is creating a schism in the
Sangha. All right, that's one.
Okay, that's it.
Yeah, okay, we got 4 out of the 5. I think that's 80%. We're good. Anybody can look that up. They're called either the 5 inexpiable actions, which is not a good translation, or the 5 actions of immediate consequence. And what that's the actual what it's called in Tibetan. And what it means is that when you die, if you've done one of these things, when you die, you go straight to hell. Like there's not even a bardo. You just straight to hell. There's no other possibility for you. So anyway, but the other way that it's sometimes expressed is that you could be born into a situation where you're forced to accumulate negative karma. You have no control over your situation. And an example that's sometimes used is, say, someone who's born, and this happens in the world, you're born in a place where, like, at age 7, you're given a gun and you have to kill people. You have to go out and be in a war and kill people, and you have no control over that. So if we don't have that, then that's a resource that we have, is not to have insurmountable negative karma, like no control over our actions, and we have to accumulate terrible karma. And then the fifth one is to have faith in the 3 jewels. And there's going to be more about that at the end of the chapter. It's one of the big topics in the chapter. So does anybody, let's do the 5 external resources, and then if anybody has any questions or comments, we can take those. So page 27 of my Ornament of Precious Liberation, the 5 other related assets or assets that have to come from outside, a Buddha has manifested in the world. So sometimes that's not true. You could have eons and eons with no Buddha appearing. So a Buddha has appeared in our era. The Buddha taught the Dharma. So you could have lots of Buddhas. You could have an infinite number of Buddhas and they choose not to teach. In fact, our Buddha, Shakyamuni, when he got up from, you know, awakening for the first time, he thought he wasn't going to teach because nobody would get it. So we're very fortunate that he taught. Third one is that the teachings still live. We still have access to the teachings. They haven't died out. That's a thing that can happen. Fourth, that there are followers of the teachings. Like it's not just an academic, like it's not just alive in an academic sense that you studied in college, but there are teachers and practitioners. So we have like a sangha, we have a practice environment. And then fifth, this is another one that's expressed in very many different ways. What it seems to mean is that we have everything we need to practice, often through the kindness of benefactors. And so if you live in a Tibetan monastery, say, and you don't have other resources, but people give you offerings so that you can do your practice, that's what that means. So for us, we're really lucky. We have, say, a job. Our financial situation is such that we have time to practice. We're not working, hopefully, 6 jobs and never getting any sleep and absolutely no time to practice. We have that. So for us, it might not be like that kind of a benefactor per se, like somebody supporting our practice financially, but we are able to support our own practice financially because of circumstances. Thank goodness there's a job for us or whatever. So those are the 10 resources. Let me see if there's anything else about those. I have a note to look at Rinpoche Tulku, page 18. Right, so he said something sort of inspiring about this. He says, we already have the precious human body. This is near the top of the page 18. Let's now think carefully and see whether we have all these 10 great possessions, the resources. If we do not, let's try to create these conditions. If we do have them, then we should be happy, rejoice, and understand that having these good conditions to practice, having this unique opportunity to end all the pain and confusion of the world and thereby help all living beings, we should work hard to achieve that goal. So if we're missing any of them, I'm not sure what we'd be missing, but we might be that person who has to have six jobs to support the family and no time to practice the Dharma. And some of us may have that. You know, I know Dan's here and he has like a young child that he's been like the stay-at-home parent for several years now. And having a young child to keep track of can really impede your Dharma practice, your leisure to practice the Dharma. It's a temporary situation, but we can encounter circumstances that don't allow us to practice. I've been in that situation myself. So if we don't have or we're missing one of the 10 resources, then we just work to get it, or we patiently wait for it, or we make use of whatever time we possibly can. And if we do have it, then we should rejoice and not waste it. So those are the first main points of the precious human existence. Anybody have any questions or comments? Okay, I'm going to unmute you, Marilyn, and then John. Marilyn?
When we get to the fifth, let's see, there are people who support the Dharma. Mm-hmm. I've always thought of that as all the people who've contributed to Lama Nyurla Rinpoche's monastery, who supported him, Patrick and I wouldn't have met the Dharma without Lama Nyurla.
Yeah.
And Lama Nyurla wouldn't have gotten here without all that other things. So there are tons of people who are, in my mind, supporting my practice.
Yeah, that's a great thought. Thanks for adding that. And then John, and then Chet. Okay, John, you're on.
Okay, I want to clarify my understanding here of these 10 resources.
Mm-hmm.
That you don't necessarily need to be born having these, that mm-hmm. you can develop them along the way and get them. Is that correct?
Well, that's what Rinpoche Tulku is saying. There, some of them obviously are not. Like, if you're not born human, like, you can't do anything about that in this life, and you wouldn't even know that you couldn't. But, for example, having your faculties intact enough. I mean, somebody could be born with some kind of a handicap that could be a handicap to them, and they would have to surmount it. I think of Helen Keller, for example, when she was born, like being blind and deaf was like, you know, there's nothing we can do for you. But she herself worked her way out of that with some help, with a benefactor, and became able, she put herself in a position where, yes, if she had encountered the Dharma, like our Dharma, then maybe she would have practiced it, but she certainly would have been able to. So I think each one you have to look at individually as to whether you could, is something you could develop. If you're in a country where there's no Dharma and you find out about the Dharma somehow, maybe you could move. So each one has to be looked at. And if you're born, yeah. I'm gonna let Lama Jinzong speak here, and then we'll come back to Chet.
I just want to say that in agreeing with Chidren, I mean, the reality here is this is dated. You know, this is pre-technology, et cetera. And I know that's why even the use of the term mute, I feel is questionable, because really what Lama Nyurla Rinpoche was saying in this day and age, it's really got to do with whether you're able to comprehend or not. And like even now, the idea of being born in a country that's uncivilized, which Rinpoche had said was like where, like it's the opposite, where people are thinking that to take life, like to sacrifice life, is good. Like they've got completely confused notions of what's good and bad. It's not that they haven't been, that they don't have access to a spiritual, you know, philosophy, but rather that philosophy sort of teaches upside down, he would say, like, you know, what's right is wrong and what's wrong is right. But certainly in this day and age, I mean, you can be born in countries like that, and now you have the internet, and now you have social media, and so you can find out about things. So just in terms of your saying, I'm just agreeing with you, John, about how things you can develop, that, you know, I do think that, again, this is dated, and we should be careful, you know, again, that whatever we understand now to be like again, mute, it's not even about not having full faculties. And he just basically would say, it's Lama Nyurla Rinpoche, that it was having the intellectual capacity to understand that anything else can be worked through with technology, et cetera. So I'm just confirming or supporting right. Children's things. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. John, is your question answered?
Yeah, that was it.
Okay, great. And then Chet, I'm going to unmute you.
Well, my comment's actually a follow-up to all this, which is, since, you know, part of the Dharma path is thinking about this every day, I've actually added, I guess, a sixth asset.
Okay.
And we're in it right now. It's our cyber sangha, you know, and Insoo was just making mm-hmm. reference to that. You know, you can take a teachings with Pema Chodron online or maybe, yeah. You know, all the kinds of teachings we have access to now because of the technology. And I'm looking at you, I'm looking at everyone else yeah. sitting here, and we're discussing this, which would be impossible not that long ago.
Yeah. We were all feeling it not long ago. Like, everybody's moved far away, and where's the sangha? Yeah. Excellent point. Anything further, chat?
Nope.
Thank okay. you. I see Patrick. I'm going to unmute you.
I was just thinking of that cyber influence there, that it could be like the people that went to India to get texts, you know, and bring them back through all the running through the Himalayas, you know. This yeah. is easier than that.
Yeah. Yeah, Tibet was once what would be considered an uncivilized country, like, or a country where there was no Dharma, like yeah. it was bereft of the Dharma, and through the efforts of, like, the immense, inconceivable efforts of certain people, the Dharma was brought to Tibet. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for that observation, Patrick. Anybody else have anything? Oops, coming back to, yes, Marilyn.
Well, I don't think this too much anymore, but I did in the very beginning. How amazing that we have access to these teachings, because once, you know, Madame Alexandra David Neal tracked her way into Tibet. Yes. I mean, you know, yes. so, and here we are 50 years ago, 60 years ago, 70 years yeah. ago, just a glimmer would have been available to us.
Yeah, and now we could even feel overwhelmed by the amount of Dharma that's available to us. Oh, it's too much. Yes, and on that note, I just want to, and I think everybody here knows that Kala Rinpoche's teachings are accessible. You know, the videos of those are accessible online. And so you can go to the KTC Facebook page or website and find a link to those if you want to hear them, if you're not overwhelmed with all of your other Dharma opportunities. Okay, anybody else? Okay, then we're going to plunge forward.
I just want to echo what you guys were just saying, which is, I mean, I started a long time ago with the early translation of the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, or no, the, just the Bardo book.
The Tibetan Book of the Dead?
Evans Wentz. Yeah. And that was so, I mean, dense and, you know, translated in a strange way. And it's so amazing to have, you know, want to thank you guys who have devoted themselves, yourselves, to the Dharma to, you know, stick with it and make it easier for us to understand, you know.
It's true. Yes, our resources have developed immensely. So, John, thanks for the question, because I think it's helping us appreciate how there have been fewer resources available in the past, and now we have more. I remember when the fifth retreat was about to start at KTC. What was that, 1999, Jinzong? 1999, you went into the fifth retreat? Anyway, it was the fifth retreat is the point. And before they went in, Lama Narlerbje was making a little speech, and he said, well, the first retreat had, 20% of what they needed. Like, they went in with 20% of what they needed to really do the retreat. Like, nothing was translated. They didn't even have texts for things. They had to write them by hand, you know, copying Lama Norla's text. So he said they had 20% of what they needed to complete the retreat. And of course they completed the retreat, but oh my God, the work that it took and the obstacles that they had. And he said the second retreat had 40% of what they needed. And the third retreat had 60%, because, you know, you just kept creating, you know, each retreat would leave more resources for the next retreat. Fourth retreat had 80% of what they needed, and they did a lot of work. They created the first LAM rooms, which is the guides to how you do a practice. And then the fifth retreat had 100% of what they needed. And I did the seventh retreat, so I figure we had 140%. And that seems to be the direction we're going in now. So anyway, yes, our resources have developed. And through benefactors of all kinds, like financial benefactors who, as Marilyn pointed out, have supported Lama Norla Rinpoche, the monastery and Dharma activity. And then people who just put the work into it, like say Lama Jinzong, who has given her life to KTC and, you know, to making the audio recordings and now video recordings available to people. So on all those levels, yeah, we have benefactors and our resources are getting better and better. So anything else before we go back to the book? All right. So on in Ornament of Precious Liberation, we are on now on page, we're still on page 17. And so, okay, so now the next point, why is it precious? Like what makes it precious? So we're halfway down the page, page 27. Someone possessing these 10 personal and situational factors is called a person with the very best assets. When these two are complete, the freedoms and the resources, that is the precious human existence. So you officially have a precious human existence when you have the freedoms and the resources. Why is it called precious? Gampopa asks. It is so termed because being rarely encountered, meaning it's hard to come by, like there's a lot more earthworms probably than there are human beings. And as I say, there's a lot more human beings than there are people with precious human existence. So it's rare. It's rarely encountered and it's exceedingly beneficial and useful, and he's going to get to that. Its qualities are comparable to those of a wish-fulfilling gem. So if we have a precious human existence, we have a wish-fulfilling gem. We can make all of our wishes come true. So then he's going to go through point by point, these points of why it is precious. So first, it is rarely encountered. It says in the Bodhisattva collection, which is another text, it is difficult to be born human, and then it is difficult to stay alive. The noble Dharma is a rare thing to obtain, and it is also rare for a Buddha to manifest. So we're going to So on page 28, I'm going to read another quote along those same lines. I just think it's poignant to read this. It's like it almost brings tears to your eyes to read this. It is rare. This is from the Marvelous Array Sutra. That's a sutra that's very often quoted and has under very many different translations of the title, the Marvelous Array Sutra. It is rare to encounter that which is free from the 8 unfavorable circumstances. It is rare, too, to be born human. It is also rare to obtain the very best form of freedom in its plenitude. It is rare, too, for a Buddha to manifest. It is also rare not to have deficient faculties. It is rare, too, to be able to study the Buddha Dharma. It is also rare to be in the company of holy beings. I mean, I'm just checking them off, you know, that we have all of these things and how amazing it is. How many holy beings have we had the good fortune to be in company with, like thanks to Lama Norla originally? It is rare too to find truly qualified spiritual teachers, like someone who will work with you. It is also rare to be able to practice properly that which has been taught so purely. We're probably all familiar with that one. It is rare too to maintain a truly right livelihood, like where you're not accumulating any negative karma from what you do in your life, and rare in the human world to earnestly do what is in accord with Dharma. So he's made the point, like in all these ways, it's really rare to actually find yourself with a precious human existence. And so to go a little further down the page, what could exemplify this rarity for whom it is so rare, and just why it is such a rare thing? And he quotes from the Bodhisattva Way of Life, Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life. And so I was thinking that, like, here we are in the 21st century, and Gampopa was teaching this in the 12th century. Like, that's many centuries ago. And he's quoting Shantideva, who lived in the 8th century, which is relatively more or less contemporaneous with Guru Rinpoche, like when the Dharma was really first coming to Tibet. All of these things, we're so fortunate that all of these things have come down to us and survived. That's the third of the five external assets or resources. So he quotes Shantideva, on account of it being like that, so this is the example, this is the metaphor, the analogy that shows how rare it is to attain a precious human existence. On account of it being like that, The Buddha has said that to be human is as rare as a turtle putting its neck through the hole of a wooden yoke floating on a turbulent ocean. Like, not even a calm ocean, but a turbulent ocean. Like, you almost got it and there it goes. Like, the wave comes and crashes it away from you. I'm going to read the next expression of that. Were this vast land to be transformed into water? So let's imagine, like, the whole earth as nothing but water. And were someone, must be Noah, were someone to set afloat a single one-holed wooden yoke, you know, like a life preserver sort of, but made of wood, because that's what they had. So the whole world is water. Somebody thinks to put a one-holed wooden yoke on the surface of the water to be driven in the four directions by the winds. You get a nearsighted turtle who can't even see the yoke. How long would it take him? It might take him thousands of years to actually end up in the right place at the right time and see well enough to get its head through the yoke. That's how rare it is. So he's really taking this to an extreme to show us how really rare it is for us to have a precious human existence. Right, and actually there's a very nice, Ringu Tulku also describes that on page 18. We're not going to read that now just because we have other things to cover, but if you're reading Ringu Tulku, pay attention to his description of the turtle, the sea turtle, and the yoke, the nearsighted sea turtle. I didn't remember the nearsighted part or the turbulent ocean part. So on to page 29, and the next point is, like, why is it so rare? So, like, it's rare. So we could just take the Buddha's word for that, right? That scriptural authority. But now we could go to logical authority. Like, why? What makes it so rare? Why is it so hard to get a precious human body? The rarity, says Gampopa, is due to causality. Since the principal cause for obtaining an existence with freedoms and assets is a prior accumulation of merit in the continuum of lives. So of all the lives we've had, Lama Norla Rinpoche used to say trillions of lives, or whatever he said that Jondran translated as trillions. It obviously is a big number. Trillions of lives and so many different kinds of trouble we can get ourselves into in every single one of those lifetimes. We have, in order to get a precious human existence, we have to accumulate merit. So that's the cause. And that's why it's rare, is because most people either don't have the opportunity or they don't have the, you know, the sort of whatever it takes internally to accumulate the merit that it would take to just engage only in virtuous actions and not do anything bad, not accumulate any negative karma, for example. That's what it takes to get a precious human existence. So without any pride whatsoever, because Kala Rinpoche instructed us to dissolve pride above all else, we should congratulate ourselves that we must have done some good things in our past lifetimes in order to have the situation we have today. All right. Right, and so Ringu Tulku on page 18 expresses this as the great privilege of having gathered all the right conditions to practice Dharma is the direct result of merit accumulated through positive deeds. It is not by chance that we have this precious human body, but because of our great efforts, our long, hard work in accumulating merit in the past. Therefore, we should not waste this very precious opportunity. If we waste it now, we may not have another for many hundreds of years, or maybe thousands, if, you know, if it's like that turtle. We could be the next blind turtle. actually, I think I've heard it said that way, not like a poor-sighted turtle, but a blind turtle. I think Lama Norla Rinpoche used to say it that way. So now we understand what goes into a precious human existence, which is freedoms and resources, very specific kinds. That it's rare to find a precious human existence. Did I miss anything? Right, that it's precious because it's rarely encountered and exceedingly beneficial and useful. So why is it rare? It's rare, it's this rare. It's as rare as the turtle finding the yolk on the turbulent sea. And it's rare because you have to accumulate merit. You have to be a very good person to get a precious human existence. So the next point, I'm just looking to see if easily, I'm not seeing easily destroyed in here particularly as a thing in Gampopa. It might be further on, but that, I feel like there was something in here and I'm not seeing it. So another point, the other point from the first reminder, first I must meditate on this precious human existence with its freedoms and resources, difficult to attain, we got all those, and then easily destroyed. So we know that it's easily destroyed, and Zhangong Kongchul gives us a lot of examples of how it's easily destroyed in the Torch of Certainty. I mean, you could step off the curb the wrong way, and your precious human existence is gone. Anything could happen. So that is the, like, that's the what impels us to actually make use of it. Not only think we'll make use of it before we die, thinking we have another 20 years or 30 years, but we got to make use of it right now because we don't know what's going to happen like a minute from now. I mean, something could fall on our house. That happens to people. So the next point is that it is exceedingly beneficial and useful. Still on page 29. That's the other thing that makes it precious. It's rare and it's very, very useful, like a wish-fulfilling gem. And I'm going to leave that at that, just that, sorry. A human existence endowed with the freedoms and assets is this, quote, able human life because it has the strength or ability to attain higher rebirth and ultimate good. It's basically precious because, another reason it's precious is because we can use it to attain awakening. We can use it to attain Buddhahood and benefit all beings. So then he talks about, and we're very familiar with this from the 37 practices, he talks about middle of page 29, further, since there are three levels of this ability, there will be three corresponding categories of powerful human potential. So we had five categories of potential for Buddha nature, and we have three categories of potential for precious human existence. So he says, those with the lesser type of powerful human potential have the ability to achieve human or divine rebirth, meaning they're born in a higher realm, either in the human realm or one of the gods' realms, by avoiding descent into the lower states. So that's we're familiar with this, and we're going to actually, I'm going to screen share now, and we're going to chant together the verse 8, which is exactly this, the sort of the lowest. It's necessary. We don't want to, like, you know, out of pride, disparage it. We need this level of motivation. But so sort of the first level of motivation is as described in the 37 practices verse. Sorry for the scrolling. I hope nobody gets seasick. Verse 8. To refrain from harm at all costs. So this is the lowest level of aspiration, aspiring to freedom from suffering. Like, you don't want to suffer. So you practice. You don't want to go to the lower realms, so you practice, so that you can be born in the human realm or above next time, and so that you won't have suffering in this life. So we'll chant that together. Those of us who can see the screen, if you can't, then you can listen. The sufferings of the three lower realms, these states of mind so difficult to bear, according to the teachings of the sage, are the result of actions that cause harm. Therefore, even with my own life at stake, from harmful actions always to refrain. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. So that's the lowest level of precious human existence, of motivation to practice. And I think we could ask ourselves in a moment of contemplation, like, am I even doing that one? Like, am I even refraining from harm? Am I succeeding in refraining from doing any harm so that I won't find myself plunged further into samsara and suffering? So bottom of page 29, those with the middling human ability are able to attain a state of peace and well-being by liberating themselves from samsara. So this is the path of individual liberation, where you're going to free yourself from suffering. You're not only going to get a better, like a human existence or a samsaric existence that has less suffering, but you're going to free yourself from suffering altogether. And that's verse 9, to strive for unchanging freedom. Like drops of dew upon each blade of grass, the three realms' happiness evaporates. In contrast, the supreme and highest state of liberation doesn't ever change. To strive in all our efforts to be free, this is the way a bodhisattva trains. So level one, refrain from harm. Level two, everything we do in this life should be directed at freeing ourselves from samsara. That's the middling level of motivation. And then page 30, those with the highest human ability are capable of attaining Buddhahood for the benefit of sentient beings. That's what we call full awakening, is the Mahayana motivation to not only free yourself from samsara and suffering, but to free all sentient beings. And that's verse 10. We're going to chant that one. My mothers, each and every sentient being, since time without beginning cared for me. How can I be happy while they're suffering? I must get to work to set them free, to cultivate the mind of full awakening. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. So we got four verses into this chapter. I looked and there weren't any verses that seemed to apply to Buddha nature. So that's the three levels of motivation, or the three like levels of precious human existence, like how you can use it, ways of using your precious human existence. So the other reason, right, that it was precious because it's rare, and it's precious because it can be given great meaning. We can attain Buddhahood through it. Towards the bottom of page 30, he talks more about this. This human existence endowed with freedom and resources gives the ability to relinquish non-virtue, that's level one, refrain from harm, to cross samsara's ocean, that's level two, getting out of samsara yourself, tread the path of enlightenment and attain perfect Buddhahood. And those last two, that has to be the Mahayana level. Therefore, such an existence is far superior to those of gods, nagas, and the like. It is something even better than a most precious wish-fulfilling gem. Because this human existence endowed with freedoms and assets or resources is hard to obtain and of such great benefit, it is called most precious. Oh, here's easily destroyed, bottom of page 30. I knew it was in here. Although it is so hard to obtain and of such tremendous benefit, two of the three reasons it's precious. Third reason it's precious is it is very easily destroyed. This is because there is nothing that can perpetuate the life force. That can perpetuate the life force. There are many causes of death, and the flow of moments never ceases. Thus it says in the Guide to the Bodhisattva Way of Life, it is not right to contentedly think, at least I won't die today. It is without doubt that at one time or another, I will be annihilated. So now we take, you know, one more little thing before we get to the three kinds of faith, which is one of the most important things in the chapter. So we'll just quickly look at this observation on page 31. Thus, through its rarity, its fragility, and its real purpose, the three things that make it precious, this physical existence should be considered a boat for doing whatever is needed to find a haven from the ocean of samsara. So this is the first of three analogies for how we can use, how we make use of it, how we make it meaningful. So in the last sentence of the first reminder, from now on, I must make this life meaningful. How do we do it? Three analogies, and I'm going to screen share one more time because this is verse one of the 37 practices. And so we get to chant that. This precious human life so hard to find, its freedoms and resources like a boat to navigate samsara's endless sea and set myself and other beings free without distraction, always day and night. To study, contemplate, and meditate. This is the way a bodhisattva trains. So how do we make this precious human life meaningful? We see it as a boat to take us to the other shore of freedom from confusion and suffering, freedom from samsara. So then the second analogy, considering this existence as a steed, as a horse, to be ridden, do whatever must be done to get free from the hazardous path of samsara and suffering. So you get on your horse of the precious human existence and you ride out a dodge. And then the third analogy, considering this physical existence as a servant, make it do wholesome tasks. So you order your precious human existence, refrain from harm, engage only in positive actions, and pay attention to what you're doing so that you don't lose track of it. So a boat, a horse, and a servant. So we only have a few minutes left, and I want to use most of it for the three kinds of faith. Does anybody have any pressing question or any pressing comment? I'm going to unmute you, John, if I can. Yep.
Okay. We're doing it's precious human existence. So I wanted to clarify, when I think of human, and when we think of human, is it just our world, the Earth, the planet, or is there other humans that we don't know about?
I think that's a great question, and I personally don't know, but Sita Rinpoche talked a whole lot about other universes, how you could be born in other universes. So I think maybe there must be other possibilities. It might not just be human. Maybe in this other universe, they're called something else, the precious human, you know. I don't know. Yes, Lama Jinzong has a comment here.
Well, you know, curiously, it says that one of the qualities of the Buddha is that he can speak in whatever language is understandable to whatever being. So perhaps it's just that we're humans. And so from our perspective and from our ability to be aware, it's manifested to us in this language because this is what we connect with. But maybe, who knows, maybe there are plenty of texts like this that have manifest in all different languages and all different universes, and the beings there are able to recognize themselves, because obviously we wouldn't recognize ourselves in a book that didn't describe us. So I'm just putting that out.
Yes, yes, brilliant. Thank you. I think that's a great answer. And I've had the fantasy at various times, like my life that I didn't live because I can't draw anyway, is like as a cartoonist. I have lots of ideas for like cartoons for things, especially Buddhist things. And one of them is like this tree, you know, and I can't remember exactly, but something about, you know, how lucky I am to be the precious leaf, have the precious leaf existence. Of all the leaves on the tree, I have the precious leaf existence, or I have the precious squirrel existence. So that speaks to what Lama Jinzong said. The Buddha might be teaching squirrels in a completely different context. So John, did that answer your question?
Yeah, because sometimes I feel like I'm limiting my I don't know, awareness, you know, myself, you know.
Yeah.
View.
Your vision, yeah.
My view of it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I think we could think, like, when we're talking about all sentient beings, we could be talking about all sentient beings, not on the earth necessarily, but throughout the universe, whatever that may entail. And I think universe we think of as a comprehensive thing, although there could be many, many universes as well. So throughout all the worlds that there are, you know, we aspire to benefit all those sentient beings. Anything else, John?
No, thanks.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else? Okay, then we're going to look at the three kinds of faith very briefly. And again, on the Dharma path, that's in level one. Like really, at the beginning of the Dharma path, we study the three kinds of faith from Gampopa, from this exact text. So we're on page 31, the three types of faith toward the bottom of the page. In order, and I'm remembering now that Lama Jinzong very kindly gave the page references from the other translation, Jewel Ornament, but I did not do that. So sorry about that. The three types of faith, in order to act in such a way, meaning to make use of your human existence as a boat, as a horse, as a servant, faith is needed. It is said that without faith, noble qualities will not develop in a person. And what is meant by noble qualities? I mean, that could cover a lot of ground in English. But noble, when it's used in a Dharma context, generally means someone who understands emptiness, someone who sees the reality of things, sees things the way they really are. So we won't, without faith, we will never be able to, you know, get rid of our confusion, according to Gampopa. And I'm going to skip the quotes supporting that, the scriptural, you know, evidence, and go to the top of page 32. What exactly does faith mean? When analyzed, it has three aspects: faith as conviction, faith as aspiration, and faith as clear joy. And I'm going to say at the beginning, and the UKDC people will probably remember this, that the way that Gampopa explains the three kinds of faith is actually different. It's in reverse order from the way everybody else explains it, including Ringu Tulku, who's writing a commentary on this text. He does it the other way around. And that's the way I like it, because the other way around, you can see it as a progression. But I'm going to read Gampopa here, and then I think we'll have time to look at Ringu Tulku on this, because it's basically the last topic. So first kind of faith, according to Gampopa, faith is conviction, arises from contemplating actions and their consequences, the truth of suffering, and the truth of suffering's origin. So we're talking here about understanding karma, understanding the Four Noble Truths. You start to have a conviction that the Buddha's teachings, when you look at your own experience and you see that the Buddha's teachings are borne out in your experience, then that's the faith of conviction. Like, you see that it's true. Conviction means being convinced that the consequence of virtuous action is to experience well-being in the desire realm. The consequence of non-virtuous action is to experience misery in the desire realm. And the consequence of unwavering karma is to experience well-being in the form and formless realms. It means being convinced that through the power of karma and afflictions, explained as the truth of all origination, you will obtain the five contaminated aggregates, that's the five skandhas, explained as the truth of suffering, that your confusion comes about through all of these things. Second kind of faith, here faith as aspiration, is to consider highest enlightenment as something very special indeed, and to ardently study how it can be attained. And faith as clear joy, and he explains in the footnote, or the end note, that it could just be lucidity. Like, it could be translated either joy or lucidity, and he's going for joy, and he explains why. But he says Kala Rinpoche favored just the faith of lucidity, and we always called it, like in the early days when we were first encountering this, it was translated as clear faith. So that's in accordance with how Kala Rinpoche explains it. So faith as clear joy, or as lucid faith, is something stable that emerges with respect to its object, the three jewels, being a joyful, clear mind that has devotion and respect for the most precious Buddha as a teacher of the path, for the most precious Dharma as that which is the path itself, and for the most precious Sangha as the companions who practice the path. Meaning that you see, you learn of the three jewels and you develop reverence and inspiration based on that. So I'm going to read this from Ringu Tulku in our last minutes, page 20 of Ringu Tulku. So he does it in reverse order, which is also how Kala Rinpoche does it in Luminous Mind. And in this way, it becomes like a progression. You start out with the first kind and it progresses to the third kind. So he says, the first is the faith of appreciation or inspiration. It springs up in the mind of someone who is impressed when he or she sees or hears something very holy or very pure. One then feels a kind of inspiration or appreciation. So like that's like how when I first met Lama Norla Rinpoche, I wasn't looking for Tibetan Buddhism, but I was just completely bowled over and inspired by his presence. And it's like, I'm doing that. Like, I don't know what that is even, but I'm doing that. So that's the faith of inspiration. I felt faith that this was something really special, really meaningful, really good, and that's how I wanted to live my life, just from seeing Lama Norla Rinpoche. The second, the faith of desire, the faith of wanting, I call it the faith of aspiration, which is also what Ken Holmes called it. So we'll call the second the faith of aspiration. So of inspiration, which is, Ringu Tulku says, still a shallow kind of faith. You know, you're just kind of wowed and awed by something that you recognize as authentic, but you don't know anything about it yet. You don't have the idea in the faith of inspiration that you could do this. You just see that it's something amazing. So the second, the faith of aspiration, means that on seeing something very good or inspiring, someone with great wisdom and compassion, such as a Buddha, a strong wish arises. I would also like to become that. This kind of wanting is called the faith of desire. So it's also explained, I think, by Kala Rinpoche as like you realize that you could do this too, and so you go on the path. You do what you have to do to become like that. It's not just sort of an abstract thing that you admire. And then the third and strongest type of faith is complete trust. It is not blind faith, but total confidence born from understanding. Complete understanding naturally gives rise to complete faith. So he goes on to talk about, we're not going to read it, but he goes on to talk about that Buddhism is not about blind faith. It's never blind faith. We have the faith of inspiration that we actually can see something is authentic. We recognize that in our heart. And then we develop the faith of aspiration. I'm going to do that too. I'm going to be like that too. That's my aspiration. And then conviction is like, yes, it's really unfolding the way that it's been described to me. Karma is really true. The Four Noble Truths are really true, and so forth. So you begin to live it, and you begin to see it directly, like the validity of it. So we haven't got any time left. I'm just going to briefly summarize the last section of this chapter, which is your faith is considered stable when you don't stray away from the Dharma. Like, you stay on the Dharma path. It stays, like, you continue. You don't, like, you're not, like, wishy-washy about it. And so there's four ways that we can, like, we can become destabilized in our faith. And so one of them is temptation or desire, like we want something else and we go in that way and we give up the Dharma because we want to enjoy something else. The other one is aggression or hostility, meaning you would act against the Dharma. You would sort of give up your faith in order to get revenge on somebody. Like, you would just, you know, I think that's fairly clear. Fear, like if somebody's threatening you, like you, and then this happened to Tibetans, and you know, when the communists invaded, you have to give up your religion, or we're going to kill you. We're going to torture you and kill you and kill your family, and not to give up the Dharma in that situation is to not stray from the Dharma despite fear. And then the fourth one is confusion could interrupt your faith, meaning someone thinks they have a better idea and you get swayed by that in the moment. So that's pretty much it. So, the benefits, what's the biggest benefit of, is this the benefit of faith? Right, the benefit of faith is, it is taught that all the Buddhas, the blessed ones, will appear before a person of faith. So if you have faith, they will be there. So he ends the chapter by saying, thus, a most precious human existence, having two sets of qualities, the freedoms and the resources, as well as three mental qualities, which are the three types of faith, this is the proper basis for achieving peerless enlightenment. So that brings us to the end of the precious human existence, a bit of a whirlwind tour, but you feel free to reread it. And if you haven't read the Ringu Tulku yet, I highly recommend that. It's a pretty quick read. It reflects all the points and it's really easy to understand. Okay, I don't have any other notes for anything to do. Does anybody have anything they would like to say or ask before we do our dedication? Joanne, you look like you do have something. I'm going to unmute you.
Well, I just have to say, the commentary, I would highly recommend everyone reading the last paragraph that starts with these faith is described in more detail later, but he really, that aspect, the important thing to notice, that important sentence stuck with me and the sentences thereafter. And I know our
I'm sorry, Joanne, which book are you in?
Commentary.
Which
one?
Ornament of Precious Liberation? Or the Ringu Tulku? Okay.
That's kind of encapsulated everything, and mm-hmm. I will use that as a reference point.
So you're talking about which thing? Which paragraph?
It starts on page 20 and ends on page 21.
Okay. All right. Well, we won't take the time to read it now, but thank you for recommending that.
Yeah.
And he ends it, his very last paragraph is, if we have these three kinds of faith and the right conditions of the human existence, then we have the most suitable basis for the practice of Dharma, which is what Gampo has said. So it's the paragraph before that Joanne is recommending that we review. Okay, anybody else? And we will do our dedication. Oops, that's not the right sheet. Bringing our minds again to rest for a moment before we do the dedication, like remembering where we are and remembering that we're doing everything that we're doing in order to attain awakening, full awakening, in order to help all other beings attain awakening. We chant the dedication, which expresses that in different ways. This merit, may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy. Then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu, Zangpo, and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate. The blessings of the Buddha Kayas, the blessings of changeless Dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast Sangha, this dedication please fulfill. So everybody is now unmuted, and so next week we will study the third prerequisite, the third and final prerequisite for embarking upon the path. With let's see, wait a minute, let me get the. Okay, well, and Lama Jinzong, I think, will be leading us in that one, right, Lama Jinzong?
Yes.
Okay. Anything you wanted to say before we go?
Me?
Yeah.
I just wanted to say that Lamanor Lurimpache and other teachers have said that there's, you know, we can't be scared off by this notion of faith. That's, you know, that faith is something that is contrived in the beginning and has to be contrived, and that slowly, slowly we begin to develop it. And this notion of, you know, it's all or nothing, that sometimes people feel like there's an ideal that you, ideal. He says that that's not true. You know, you start where you are and slowly, slowly. I just felt that was helpful when he said that years ago.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for that reminder. Okay, everybody.
I gotta go. My back.
Yeah, we're done.
Bye.
Glad everybody could be here. See you next week.
Have a great week.